My name is Paul Green.
I'm an instructor at Eastern Washington University, and I teach in the recreation department. Most of my area is outdoor recreation. I have a very comprehensive program I deal with on search and rescue management, outdoor leadership, survival skills, rock climbing, rafting, canoeing, backpacking, winter camping for senior citizens, and just a variety of classes. My current classes, the ones I favor, is the ones for senior citizens, and I'll be taking them on their first field trip, January 6th, I guess, is when we go out. Where they go out and do some of the same things that you're doing here in more of an outdoor setting. They live outside, eat, cook, work together as a group. The youngest one, I think she's 67, is my youngest. The oldest is 78, and they discriminate against people under 60.
How many all the others?
Well, I had 28, but I limited the course down to 10. I think some of them were they just wanted to go shovel snow and have a good time. And you had to be kind of serious. My background has been in the Air Force as a survival instructor and as a climber and a backpacker. I've lived in a variety of climates as well as with Aboriginal pygmies for 14 months in the Philippines. So I deal with survival on a lot of different levels, and we're hoping, you know, to bring you a course that's variety so that it fits the people at Holden as well as those people that are from other areas. So when you go back, it's just not a matter of understanding one of survival, but to understand more of the fundamentals of staying warm, fundamentals of outdoor enjoyment. And for some of you who sleep cold, you might pick up on some techniques on how to better deal with some of your objective dangers. Some of you have had courses before, and there's really no way I can tell you how to sleep warm, either it's blood pressure or valves or something like that. But some of you that have experienced miserable nights backpacking or camping, I think we can address ourselves with some of the problems you might face and how to correct them. My assistant on this trip is Martin Castle, back over here. Martin is a senior in the program that I deal with, and I brought him along because he's been a teaching assistant. He has a lot of experience behind him. 6 months at the South Pole and 3 months at the North Pole. He's a backpacker, climber, a really good person. He's lived in the Canadian territory, 700 miles from the closest establishment for a good period of time. Very dependable person, and I'm sure we'll be able to put out a good effort for you. You really need to make some definitions and kind of get some type of dialogue. I tend to like to walk around because I'm an academic instructor. I'm not used to sitting and lecturing. So if it bothers you, if I don't get eye contact, just raise your hand or something like that. But I'll give it a shot. Second thing is we do issue a diploma that kind of commemorates this course at Holden. It's a very cherished thing by those people who go through the course. A lot of people have gotten them. And it is exciting. It's something you can put on your wall to remind you mostly of Holden Village rather than my lecture. We do have a certain requirement, though. And this requirement also helps us in water making decisions on who does overnight ski touring and who goes within a range of the village and who doesn't. So starting with our sessions on Friday morning, not tomorrow, we don't have anything tomorrow, we will have a sign-up sheet that once you sign it, there'll be an opportunity to check off the sessions as we pass it around at those particular sessions. So then on Saturday, we'll tally it up with our last class, then we'll have the diplomas printed and your name put on it. And then possibly Sunday morning, we'll be presented to you, and we generally have some award ceremony. We can pick out the best students. And we can pick out the least students. Our definitions for survival, for a lot of you, are probably heavy connotations. We were dealing with that energy simulator game, which I found to be exciting. I wish I could design something for survival where if you panic, you know, your energy level is turned up, so you burn out more calories and things like that. But it seems like someone put a lot of time into that thing. And maybe someday we will. But as we know the term survival, it's not just living a minute longer or making it through a situation, but it's also making it through in good form. We know that a lot of times when there's natural disasters or any type of emergency situation, there's a response time where people tend to become motivated. Hey, they're kind of cruising along here. We'll say a situation arises, an automobile accident. This is a survival situation. Forest fire, any type of flooding. Some of you from the Midwest are intimately familiar with winter storms. Okay? You have a situation where your everyday priorities are interrupted, and you move up to, we'll say, a panic or alarm situation. Hopefully none of us ever panic. And then you find out, from that point, you start to go back down, and you tend to go below normal function because there's a lot of depressive action that happens when individuals get into a traumatic situation. And eventually, you go back up and you're cruising again. Now, this time frame in here depends a lot upon your experience. We know statistically that people who screw up or get lost or injured in the out-of-doors, in Washington State, we have over 600 people do it a year. Statistically, none of them ever taken a survival class or been incorporated in any type of group that teaches basics or fundamentals of outdoor enjoyment. We do know that this particular response time, as far as getting into the situation, remains about the same. But coming back down, you tend to recover much faster, so our angle of getting back into the swing of things no longer is a long one, it's fairly short. This also means you'll have less traumatic overtones. I'm sure many of you have had situations where you've been away from home, something's happened, and you felt guilty because you weren't there, and you see if you were there, it would have never happened. This is quite common in many natural disasters that happen throughout the Midwest, tornadoes, a lot of your lightning storms. So when we think of survival, at least in this particular setting, let's not limit it to something that's just strictly winter survival. We'll discuss that, but let's talk kind of in three phases. We'll talk about the mental aspect, which we'll cover throughout the course. You know, the psychology, why people get into trouble. Okay, and we'll talk about some common sense in winter travel. We'll talk about some of the mountain survival problems that you can encounter. And most of you probably remember the situation when a group from Oklahoma came to Holden. Five of them checked out high cow sleeping bags and a couple of tarps, never been camping, never been backpacking. This was the middle of summer, 74, I believe it was. They went racing up the Lyman Lake, storm came in, and boom. They had a flat roof shelter, soaked sleeping bags. All five of them were extremely cold. They were so cold that the staff that was in line in the cabin had to attack them to get their clothes off and to rewarm them. Okay? So they were from an environment where they really weren't taught survival skills, and they assumed that Oklahoma and the type of weather they have there was relevant to a mountain community. And we know right away that it's not. Because as we increase elevation, for every 1,000 feet of elevation we drop anywhere from 3 to 5 degrees in temperature. We also know that wind picks up anywhere from half a mile an hour to 5 miles an hour, just by being in that 1,000 feet. So we also know there's other problems that develop as far as high altitude, and our breathing and our mental aspect, the stress, self-possession of trying to get warm. We find out the reason isn't because of insulation, but the reason is we're breathing too hard and we're pulling in cold air that's cooling our core. So a lot of these things come out once you live in a mountain community, and in this course we'll talk about those as it relates to the mental aspects, which also covers skills. Okay, we'll cover some skills in your firecraft, signaling, how to build an igloo. How many people really built snow shelters? Okay. How many people have slept in the snow shelters you built? Okay. I hope this time, looks like we've got the snow. It's going to be weird to cut blocks out of it, but I think we can pull that off too. Mike was with us last year, and he was kind of frustrated because we didn't have enough snow to make a snowball this time. And if you did, people were kind of standing on top of it waiting for it to grow. But this year we have plenty of snow. It looks like a good quality of snow. And we'll teach you how to work with it, because you know basically there's 17 different types of snows, and depending upon the type of snow you run into, it's going to be the type of shelter you want to build. I'm not going to try to teach you all 17 different types. I'm going to teach you a couple of responses that you can do to find out what type of shelter you need to build. And then we're going to talk about a third thing. So we're talking about mental aspects, the field of knowledge, appreciation. We're dealing with skills. And the third we're talking about is objective danger, you know, like a slab avalanche. And most of you already realize there's avalanche chutes on either side of the village. And some of you who have seen the bomb truck realize that at one time that was caught in a fairly heavy avalanche. And the movie that we have to show you on one of our evening sessions is Dynamite. It's really a great film. It's a moving film which really shows you the power of an airborne avalanche, slab avalanche, and some of the destruction it can cause. But we're going to talk about it not in us preventing it or forecasting exactly where avalanches will happen. But we'll talk about it, and if we're traveling through a winter environment, you know, what we do as far as safety, what we do if someone's caught in an avalanche, what are our rescue procedures, You know, and there's really a narrow limit that we can deal with as far as avalanche. So the course is summarized in three phases: our mental aspects, our skills, and then our objective danger. And throughout the course, if you like, anytime, plug in something that you're curious about. You know, there's moss growing on the north side of a tree, and things like that. Some lizards run east and west. We can kind of deal with those things too. Okay. But my challenge to you is, prior to Fridays, why don't you come up with some type or system, criteria, what you would do if you were lost? You know, what you would really do. What would be the top priority, second priority, third? Okay, and I'll probably quiz you. If we look at the schedule just briefly, we start on Friday morning with hypothermia, which is the biggest killer of recreationalists in the outdoors. It kills more people than any other type of outdoor danger, objective, or otherwise. This is a lowering of inner core temperature. If you've ever shivered, you've been a mild hypothermic. Okay, it's a natural response, but things happen if you shiver too much. If you use up too much energy, if you become calorie depleted, if you become acidotic from too much conditioning, you know, when you weren't really working up to it in gradual sequences. We'll talk about frostbite. We've got some excellent slides of people with frostbitten hands. We can diagnose how it happened with fuel, with direct exposure, with direct contact with something. We have a variety of slides that may not agree with you. But we use them not necessarily to gross you out, but for effect, because they're probably with some of the most prominent hands and feet of climbers and mountaineers in the United States. But they're also very effective. We're talking about a situation of 80% of the people in the Northwest who retain or get frostbite, I should say, of the feet. And just to know that, we know that's a high priority to protect if we're in an emergency situation. Okay? We'll talk about clothing. We'll show you a system of dressing warm that allows you to ventilate properly as well as work with the conditions you're dealing with. Then in the afternoon, we'll deal with some of the actual mountain problems that you might have as far as weather, as far as understanding panic and fear, and we'll also deal with what we call a mountain survival problem, which is our equivalent of this energy simulator. And it's just an airplane crash in North Cascades, and you have 15 items that you have to rank. And as individuals, you'll do it, and then we'll pair you up in groups of 5 or 6, and you can kind of brainstorm what's the key item that you want to have as the most high priority, what's second, third, all the way to item 15. And that's always been an interesting thing. In the evening, we'll cover avalanche with a dynamite film the British should put out. We'll talk about safety and traveling in the winter. We'll talk about what happens if you're caught in an avalanche, how to forecast a little bit. On Saturday, we'll deal with firecraft, signaling, sleeping warm, which a lot of you should key on, and then shelters. We've got a lot of slides. We've got a movie about different types of snow shelters. And in the afternoon on Saturday, we'll go out and build them. And I think this is where you really get some good experience. And those people that have a good sleeping bag, a fairly warm one, a good pad, we can just set you up for the night in one of the shelters. No extra charge. And a few years ago, we did that. I went out to pick up the snow tools, and I heard a noise in one of the igloos, and I went in there, it was just packed full of people. It looked like a small apartment party. They did okay. The only thing was that we brought one shelter down, or Wes helped us direct one shelter down by the pool hall, and it was right where the snow sloughs off. The people had their equipment in there, and then they went to breakfast, and when they came back out, their shelter was gone. So they had to wait until spring to get this stuff back out. So we'll talk about that as far as objective danger in the outdoors. Okay, the way we're going to cover this is through lectures, discussion, hopefully a little humor, and a lot of movies. And the reason we use movies is for motivation, you know, to get you kind of sympathetic to the idea of learning, to motivate you to be able to understand that there's a positive benefit of you listening to these presentations. You know, other than your own gain of getting a diploma and being able to ski farther and harder than anyone else. But there are some really good skills. Those of you that are in education, either in the public schools and the private sector, can probably incorporate survival education and making the curriculum more viable in a lot of public school systems. So we started off on the motivational end, especially for those people from the Midwest. This film is called Winter Storm. And it deals with some of the problems of winter storm. And I'm showing it just to kind of give you a grip on the cold, because here at Holden and elsewhere in the Cascades, our mean temperature is only about 20 degrees. But yet we know what happened when a storm moved in here a little while ago. You get 5 or 9 below, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be a winter storm. Okay, what happens in the Midwest when you're in your car? You know, and all of a sudden the energy that you've been trying to conserve and that gas tank goes out and you're stuck in the middle of the highway. And that does happen. That's happened. There's people in Montana, same situation. Could have been happening in other areas. The car broke down, they just cut all the insulation out of the interior, stuffed it in a jacket, and walked out because their engine no longer ran. Another situation, same storm, but farther in the Midwest, the guy shot himself. You know, if you're in that type of a situation, you have to know, he said the cars wouldn't stop. Okay, right away he had poor priority. Should have shot the cars, the people involved. You know, and that way you can try to brainstorm what's going on. But throughout the course, whatever we show you, whatever we can cover as far as discussion or lecture, let's try to work on one term, and hopefully this will be a carryover throughout the entire winter. And obviously Warner knows what it is, and this is our positive mental attitude. Okay. And this is kind of the key thing of being a good survivalist or a good survivalist student and learning situations, and we'll cover more on the PMA later. But first I'd like to show a movie on winter storm.
Okay.
Is that ready? And as it relates to Holden, if you're out cross country skiing and you're 7 miles out and you have a sprained ankle, you just should decide there's some area along the way, you might consider shelter, you might consider sending someone going for help. There's a factor that you have to recognize you have a problem. If you're exhausted and you're on about the third switchback going towards Lyman Lake, you know, you might consider that you've got yourself a problem. If you're lost, strained by darkness, and once you do that, that brings a whole new category into focus, because we know once you decide you have a situation that needs to be dealt with, there's other ways that we can work with that, and I'll explain those. The second thing you need to remember is you've got to pay attention to your body problem indicators, especially in winter. If you're sweating, something's wrong. You should always try to be warm, and there's a real need to be warm in the winter community, because we find out when you're cold, you make poor decisions. As you start to use a tremendous amount of energy just to keep your body warm, you find out that you might deplete your minimum resources. And what I mean by that, if you're out hiking, how many calories per hour do you think you burn hiking? Does someone have a guess? Can you get it down to minutes?
Five.
Well, that would probably be pretty close.
500.
No, an hour. So we could break it down. Generally, we're talking about travel through snow, and one of the moves that pointed out that if you're traveling and you have to post hole knee-deep, you'll burn something like 16 calories a minute. Okay? So if we're taking a short hike without the snow, we're still burning a tremendous amount of calories, but we could burn up 900 to 1,000 calories an hour. How big is a breakfast meal?
About
600. Probably 6. Some of you, it's 6. For one, it's 12. But we could deplete our breakfast meal, and we can deplete the food that we have stored away in special cells in a matter of about 2.5 hours. And the way your body does this, initially it'll burn metabolized food. Metabolism is just your food being oxidized. And so if you have food in your tank and you continually snack while you're hiking and moving along, you will tend to burn that particular energy before you burn up any stored fat. This is one of the principles of losing weight. You have to quit eating or cut down and be active in order to lose weight. And the second thing that you go to, and this is kind of a recent study, is little cells that you have. And since I'm a little heavy, I probably had more of them than you. And I was a heavy baby, so supposedly I have a lot more than some people. But these particular cells are called glycogen cells. And they're not fat cells, they differ. Fat cells kind of looks like this. But these particular cells are scattered throughout your body, and these are your stress cells. Okay, so you're hiking along, let's say John's outside working, and he ate breakfast, he ate a 300-400 calorie breakfast, and he's working that particular day, and he's hitting it pretty hard, a couple hours work in. Once his food's gone, the food that he has in his tank, he starts to attack these cells. And they have kind of like a milkshake, is when you're sticking a straw in it, you can go to different layers. If you're doing really hard work, it'll just empty these cells out. And eventually they'll just shrivel and they won't have any more energy. And it kind of empties them simultaneously. So eventually all of these cells in a stress situation, being cold, working in an environment where you have to actually decrease a lot of the calories to keep up with the physical demand, these cells will start to deplete, and then you start to break down fat cells. But the key to breaking down fat is you have to kind of rest. You know, most long-distance runners do a thing called stacking carbs, where they eat a lot of spaghetti, a lot of pizza, a lot of foods like that prior to a run, because they know while they're running, they're going to burn everything in their tank initially, and then they're going to start to destroy these cells. They don't destroy them, they just deplete them. And also, while they're running, they won't be breaking down fat cells, because you generally have to stop. You can't have your blood supply working on two projects at the same time. You can either digest food effectively and think, or most of us try to, or you can think and just kind of sit around. But it's really hard to digest food, think, and work at the same time, because there's just not a blood supply that'll spread itself out. So if we're in a situation and we're talking about recognizing a problem, if you're dealing with a trip, and it's been a lot of them, people come out of hole and they say, well, we're going to take a trip to Lyman Lake in the winter. Okay, you know there's a great elevation gain there, we know it's lodgement expense, and they take a 3,000 or 4,000 calorie diet per person per day. And that's enough probably to last you a half a day if you're really putting out energy. People who work in search and rescue are probably using 8,000 calories a day, and they carry that much. I don't say it's 8,000 calories, but it's a big pile of calories. In the winter community, it's necessary, not because you're getting away from the village itself and you feel like eating more, but because when you get in a cold environment, research has indicated that you have to maintain normal body heat, okay, 24 hours a day. And as soon as you step outside of your artificial environment that we have here, you're going to be burning more calories, and it's substantial. When you're doing vigor exercise and you're not in really good shape, you tend to burn more calories than if you're in good condition. Conditioning means that you can do the same activity and use less energy because you're more in tune. Okay? So that would be recognizing you have a problem. And that would be recognizing body problem indicators. If you start to look pale, it isn't because you're getting frostbite, you're getting calorie depleted in many cases. If you're seeing people coming off a strenuous hike, I always look at a lot of my students as they're coming back to the bus and they were on a four-day winter trip on skis, and their face is just really white. Once they get on the bus and eat something, they go back to normal color. Okay, and it's generally because your calories are down. So besides recognizing you have a problem and looking at body problem indicators, the next thing you have to do is then go ahead and take charge of the situation and use a good positive mental attitude in making your decisions. And a positive mental attitude has two factors to it. It's the will to live, okay, and it's your problem-solving ability. In many cases, people lose their will to live. And you can lose it really easily because you have a lot of things grinding on it. Have you really ever had cold feet or cold hands, and all you could think of was getting them warm? We had a hiking situation here not too long ago, 74, that's not long ago. A person wore his combat boots, they wore in Vietnam, and it snowed. And that individual was so obsessed with getting his feet warm that he missed the trail. He ran back and forth across Lyman Cabot. We thought we would have to lasso him to stop him. But he was so hung up on getting his feet warmed up that he didn't pay attention to anything else that was going on. His clothes were getting soaked from the environment, didn't have a rain jacket on. He was just really obsessed with getting, it happens with your hands. A lot of you face that particular factor in other environments. People have a drive to stay warm, they have a drive to have normal water input. People in desert environments have been driven out of a nice shelter without any water because they had such a strong drive to obtain water. And I was working on a pipeline once that was a natural gas pipeline. I went from Canada to California as a summer job. And it was really hot. It was like 109 air temp. The surface temperature was 160. The steel pipe was really hot. We were out of water. And we just started digging holes for no apparent reason. We wanted water so bad. But I don't know if you've ever been in the Palouse country in eastern Washington. You can dig a long time before you're going to find any water. But we were really motivated because we wanted to have some kind of a fluid, something in this to get our normal body water up. That same process of homeostasis will drive you to get warm, and you'll overlook a lot of the common problems that you might have. Okay. And it happens really often. People go through a real strong stress when they first start cross-country skiing with a pack. You know, they're under a lot of ego pressure because the person who actuates the trip might just have a drive to learn how to do it. You know, and it's best to camp in the ballpark prior to figuring out to go to Holden Lake and build an igloo. It's best to do it close to home. But we'll say you get involved with a cross-country ski trip. You find out you're doing really well in the village on skis, but you've never tried it with a 40-pound pack. Okay? So you get out on your skis and you start to fall and spin, and I've seen it many times, and you'll see some good cases of frostbite of individuals who don't really gear their conditioning to their activity, and they go out, they feel like they've got to keep up with the group, they refuse to recognize they have a problem, they won't look at their body problem indicators, and they really have this strong drive that they don't want to hold anybody back, you know, which is really foolish. Because it isn't necessarily you as an individual that's independent of the village. You have your own individual ways about you, but you have to appreciate there's people here that worry about you. There's a rescue team that has to go out and get you. And then there's people who worry about the rescue team while they're going out. Okay? So it's not a thing where you can say, yeah, I can do it, I'm tough, if I die, that's fine. Big hero worship thing. It doesn't work that way. You have to recognize you have limitations. You have to understand that once you get put in that situation where you feel you're behind the eight ball, you go through a lot of stress. A lot of you might have seen it in academia, where you really get behind on studying for a test and you tend to cram for it. Okay? Generally, it doesn't, in many cases, it doesn't do you any good, does it? You end up getting exhausted and some of you fall asleep or shove a pencil in your ear while you're trying to take the test. Okay? It's the same type of factor. You're developing kind of an artificial stress phenomena because you're not accepting that you have a problem, recognizing it, and dealing with it in a logical way. And we'll talk about a sequence of how to deal with survival-related problems. Is the movie ready to go?
Yeah.
New projector, huh?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, again, it's just a movie to get you in grip with the idea of a winter community and a winter storm. How we can deal with figuring out what problems we solve first. Obviously, if we were talking about community problems within the village, you have a certain hierarchy that you go to kind of solve them. But when we're talking about individual or basic survival skills, you as an individual are responsible for your own actions. You kind of control your own destiny. When these patterns that have been developed in emergencies, and one thing that really comes out is that people who tend to have a lot of emergencies or accidents usually are preoccupied. You know, they're really not into what they're doing. In a winter community, you cannot afford that. There's just no way. If you're preoccupied, you probably shouldn't really go on a trip. But if in fact you do, and you do happen to fall in that 70% pattern of those people who generate accidents, there's certain ways to get out of it. Okay? Without going to someone else for help. If you're an individual and you're controlling your own destiny, we call them the priorities of survival. The priorities themselves are actually the necessities of keeping ourselves alive. What do you think that would be if we had to line up six or five priorities of keeping ourselves alive in a day-to-day situation? What would be the top thing as far as the priority? You want to answer, you're really anxious, huh?
I was just making a joke.
Okay. If you were going to list your priorities, what does it take to live day-to-day?
Water.
Okay, water. I'll put that.
Water
says food.
Hey,
okay, shelter. Okay, what else do we need?
Warm.
Cold. Cool food. Shelter. Okay, fire. Fire could come under shelter, though. Because shelter is an extension of our clothing, and shelter and warmth could, you know, be a compatible thing. But if we didn't have fire, we could still have warmth, and we could still have clothing and use maybe snow as an insulator too. What's more important than all these, though? Well, we have to have air somewhere along here. We kind of take that for granted, unless we're in situations of high altitude. But in the winter time, you find out, as the temperatures get colder, what happens to the content of the air? Pardon? Thinner or denser?
Thinner.
It does. So you know when it's really cold temperatures, that's the same as being at high altitude. So you can develop. There's a good example of an obvious need for air. Pardon? It lacks humidity. Once it gets really cold, most of you, I think this is contrary to Minnesota, because I read about this area, you have in northern Minnesota, that it stays humid at 20 below, and supposedly man or beast or Norwegian can't live there.
Right.
I just heard rumors, but I don't know. But I know in this state and a lot of other areas, in Wyoming, if it gets really cold, it's dry. Okay, as soon as the air loses that humidity, it has the same effect on your system. Why does your nose run in the winter? Does anybody know? Have you ever thought about why you
feel that? Because when you're breathing in, you're reaction to humidify the air that you're breathing.
Right, you're humidifying the air, so the drier the air, the more your nose runs. It's not because you're getting a cold, okay? And so when you're going out in a cold environment that's extremely cold, you're sucking in that air and you're creating your own humidity, but it's the same quality of air as you would find in higher elevations. I don't know what the ratio is. So we know in a winter community that air is a consideration. Maybe not one that's obvious because we breathe it day to day. But it's one that we're concerned with because that means if we're going to do an extended trip, we want to do extensive conditioning. Being up and down here on the line carrying really isn't the conditioning necessary to carry a pack up to Lyman Lake as far as on skis. And you see that over and over again. If you're going to ski with a pack on, you practice skiing with a pack on. You don't ski and then hope that the pack adjusts to your system. It doesn't work that way. Okay, what's the most important note that's not up there?
Fire.
Well, obviously it's a positive little attitude. DNA, try to indoctrinate you. That's the will to live that someone mentioned over here. Okay, and that's improvising your needs. It's your analytical ability. There's an engineer, Gary Anderson, 38 days in the Arctic. Guy crash landed his plane on the water. It was a float plane, and they have vortex behind rocks, and the plane was sucked up. They jumped out. He was down for 38 days. All he found eating 38 days was where a hunter had scraped his eggs out of a frying pan and threw it on a sandbar. Lost 68 pounds, something like that. He's not a record. People have been out longer. But the guy was an engineer, not a survivalist, so he built a little tiny box shelter and took moss and lichens and anything he could find, dried them in the sun, and put them on a shelter. And every day he would add a layer of insulation because he knew what insulation was. He knew it was dead airspace. And he would always get in his shelter before it got too dark and cooled down and always wait until it warmed up during the day before he came out of the shelter. He knew nothing about survival, but he knew he had to have some kind of a shelter. He knew he needed to improvise his needs, so he brainstormed. And being an engineer, he knew that insulation was important. 38 days. What was really surprising about it is he said his biggest problem was being bored. You know, because he had a shelter lick, he got through the weather really well, he just didn't have a lot of things to do. So that comes back to the same thing that he used to solve his problem, his improvising ability. He had to have a will to live. He decided the river killed his father and wasn't going to kill him. He hated Alaska. He hated being up there just because he lost someone he really liked, but he decided it wasn't going to get him. So he had an attitude that was positive, but it may not have been a proper positive attitude. So maybe sometimes you might need to add a P up there, because you've seen a lot of times with people will go out and do things, and they have a good attitude. They're really motivated. I'm sure you've seen work crews that they want to go out and do everything, but they don't want to slow down and really pick up on what they really need to do. So they've got a good, positive attitude. They're going to get the job done, but it might not be a proper one. They tend to expend a lot of energy spinning their wheels on projects. Same thing happens in survival. We've seen situations where people know shelter is important, and rather than build a simple shelter that requires very little energy drain, they'll build an elaborate log cabin. And they really start to build these monsters. Well, some of you are laughing, but we're going to have a little assignments on that shelter building. As a team, you're going to have a certain criteria, what you have for tools, and you're going to build a shelter with the tools you have. One time we had phenomenal shelters. One time it looked like the Ritz. Okay? So the same four people, a group of four people had two different ideas of what shelter meant. But the one that made a functional shelter that protected from the elements, that was simple to construct, and they got in earlier, was probably better off than the Ritz. You know, although they didn't have running water, or maid service, they still had an adequate shelter that kind of could get them through the situation. Okay, let's look at this list. I say a positive attitude first, and obviously I've got the chalk, so that counts for something. But the reason I say that is because we've seen so many situations where we can't explain tragedy or death. Situations with senior citizens, and I deal with them because I think they're probably the best group I have for students, because they're really always ready to learn. But once you see a situation where two seniors have been living together a long time, okay, and the husband dies. What happens a little while later? The wife dies. And they say, well, she died of old age. Well, she didn't die of old age. She lost the will to live. She's been married for 70 years. You've taken away a significant part of that. Okay, that's possible. Taking away a significant part of that, and boom, it's gone. You've seen it yourself. A lot of you at the ages where your grandparents are at that particular stage. And it's not anything that I could say that's going to change it, because we've seen those same patterns throughout history. We've seen it in wars, we've seen it in tragedies, where people are in natural disasters and they say it's better to be dead than to be out here blowing in the snow and things like that. So they just walk over the side and they die. We saw it in the Korean War, a lot of prisoners of wars. We saw it in Vietnam. In the Korean War, from the different stories that you read, a person would have a certain look about them, their eyes would be kind of glazed over, and you knew that person was going to die. And you knew you couldn't do anything for them because they had lost the will to live. It was better to be dead than it was to face the situation they had. And it's easier to die than it is to tough things out. It really is. You'll see situations of people becoming extremely cold. They'll lose the drive to stay alive because you're just so cold and so miserable that it's kind of a trade-off to them. But at that point, you need to really pull people. In expedition climbing, you're always saying, well, I'll help my partner out. And when you're really at high altitude and you're totally exhausted and you're depleted because your canteens are frozen, you don't have any water, you ate all of your food, and you're coming down off the mountain to your high camp, I'd like to say you're going to drag your partner along, but I don't think you will. Well, your partner will make it, because generally people who do adventuresome type things, do hard skiing, do winter mountaineering, do some of the winter camping things that you're going to do, have to develop a positive attitude about it. They have to develop a strong will to live, because the situations, as far as the objective dangers, are overwhelming. And we'll see some of them in this program. I'm not trying to discourage you from skiing, but you just have to accept what goes along with it. You know, the freedom of the hills is also the responsibility upon you to learn everything you can about this particular mountain environment. Okay, so an area up here besides positive mental attitude, we have air, because we tend to take air for granted, but it is significant. Can be a serious medical emergency if we overlook it. If you try to jog at 20 below, something's probably going to happen that you don't want to happen. You might really end up with a sore throat, you might end up with worse. Okay, down here, what do you think would go number three?
Shelter.
Sure, shelter probably would. How long can we live without shelter?
Depends on how cold.
And we find this to be true in the desert as well as the mountain. It's shelter, 3 hours. If you're standing outside at 20 degrees, which we consider to be very cold, and if you have exposed skin, within an hour you can expect to create problems with frostbite if you don't have very good general body dress. Okay, so if you're in minus 20 degrees, which you consider severe cold, an hour, 2 hours, things are just going to start to develop. You become self-possessed, possibly hypothermic. You may not be able to handle your own situation. So shelter is a priority because it allows you to maintain warmth, to keep the insulating value of your clothing, and it also allows you to rest, which we don't have up here. And we know that even if we're on a limited diet, if we have water, we have the capability of resting in a warm environment, we'll be able to metabolize fat at 3,500 calories to a pound. This is why I tell my director, I always have a couple extra days with me all the time. And he kind of comments that surviving instructors should be lean and hungry, and I feel they shouldn't. You know, they've been lean and hungry too long, so they carry their kit with them, they need minimum equipment. So the next part that comes down here is water, and then obviously food comes in here somewhere. And food, how important is it? What's the record of someone going without eating anything? No solid food. Any better, 90 days, 40 days? Okay, well, he had juices, but this woman in England who just went on vitamins and water 148 days. She was obese though, so that's kind of a qualification for doing it 148 days. But there's been people in Alaska, a guy had a tube of toothpaste and went like 45 days on a tube of toothpaste. I don't know how many calories Crest has. We might compare that to something. Okay, it was a small tube, froze anyways, couldn't get it all out. Chewed on the tube. But he had a broken leg. Cut the back seat out of his plane. It was a client type plane where you carry people around. Just reached back with his knife, cut the whole back seat, all the insulation out, pulled it in the front seat, and lived for 54 days. But you can live a long time. The problem with the winter community, though, is you have to have good shelter. Because we know it's so easy to survive right in here. with a lightweight shirt on because we have a heat source. But without that particular heat source, we either need food or we need a lot of insulation, because we know heat's produced by a couple of reasons, okay? It's generally produced by radiant heat from the fire, from the baseboard heating, or it's produced by metabolized food, okay? So if you have a minimum amount of heat in the furnace, internally, if you don't have a lot of heat, then you have to compensate with good insulation and good shelter. Okay. This next film is more of an entertainment thing. I brought it just because Warner's interested in blimps. But it kind of has sequences of early flying machines in it, you know, and to benefit Warner again. But the reason for it, it talks about technological failures. And these are the things that people run into in a day-to-day community. Here you have power failures. You used to have them when I come up here. You'd show a movie and, you know, you still do, okay? We'd be waiting for lunch and the ovens would go out, you know, something like that. Those are technological failures. But we also run into those things with the automobile. We depend so hard upon it, and we put so much trust in it, that when it breaks down, we're in some hassles. In the Midwest, in a storm, getting pushed off the road possibly because there's light snow on a soft shoulder and it just drags us off the road. And then the car stalls, and then we're stuck. Family in Wyoming, a classic case. They went out on a drive on a Sunday, got into a major storm, drove down the wrong direction, got in a metal shed, you know, rather than use their automobile, got in a metal shed, no insulation. They lost all their toes and they lost their hands. They had a perfectly good car. It wasn't running any longer, but it had a lot of things you can improvise out of a car. Living with those Aboriginal pygmies, they made their machetes out of a leaf spring of a Jeep, of World War II Jeeps that were all around the Philippines left after the invasion, okay? I've seen situations where college students have taken a 56 Ford that I scrounged for them. The front half, I told them, was an Arctic shelter. The back half was a desert shelter, and they tore it apart. And then, boom, they made two dynamite shelters that were really very effective at keeping people warm. They improvised the needs. These people in Wyoming could have taken their spare tire out, you know, let the air out of it, thrown some gas on it. That would probably burn for half an hour. They could probably jump the battery cables to get some kind of a fire going. I would have burnt the whole bloody car, you know, rather than lose my hands or feet. Those are pretty significant things to me. So when we're talking about technological failures, you'll see them all the time. If there's a mechanical drawing pencil going out, it might be your automobile, and during a storm you need it. And the thing I'd like to consider, are you really prepared? I mean, could you live out of the trunk of your car? I know I could. You know, because I've seen situations, these 80-something cars piling up on ryegrass. Can't happen to me, huh? Sure. Okay, why don't we go ahead and take a look at the film? Yeah, just to put a plug in for our that energy simulator, we may discuss, you know, cutting down on unnecessary electricity. You know, in a planned brownout, I think that should be probably lifestyle. In respect that you should plan your own personal brownout so that we do conserve what resources we have, and I'm sure that'll probably be addressed, and if people are even wise, it'll be brought, I'm not sure. My point is, though, in technology, the fact we do live in a light switch tech society where we flip a switch for instant heat, we expect its response, and we're running into a variety of situations we need to be able to control through proper planning and preparation.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Okay, I'm sorry. We need to consider that we're not pioneers at Holden. You kind of are, but you still have a lot of technology you have to deal with. You still have a lot of responsibility that's your own that you need to plan for, and preparedness of being able to live out of the trunk of your car, be able to be self-sufficient, self-secure with a pack on your back, which is your home away from home type situation, is extremely important. Does anybody have any comments on the movie? Okay, let me finish up with one quick item and that'll be it for tonight. Since we have our priorities listed and we've got them in a pretty good sequence, what do you think the body's enemies might be then in relationship to these particular priorities? What are the things that tend to be the opposite of these? Okay, I'll cover air. I've already talked about you have to humidify the air in order to warm it up to bring it into your system. And this was pointed out by this gentleman over here. Can we find out that air is a potential problem in this area, tends to chill our core a lot. So we might consider a rebreather in the winter, some kind of face mask made out of wool, something we can put across our face that warms the air up. So once we breathe in, after it pulls in this 30-degree air, we warm it up to 70, blow it back out, it'll warm up our little face mask. And that way, when we're dealing with cold temperatures, it'll ice up, obviously, because we have moisture. But if you had something that you could rotate or crack the moisture out of it, like using an old sock that you knew the history of, you know, cut the end of it off, and put that over your face. And we'll show you one of those while we're here. It's called an Omidiver rebreather. The air could also be a potential problem if in a situation while we're out, we were at high altitude, because we find out decisions at high altitude are a lot different. People tend to wear faster, you tend to really fight over small things. You read about mountaineers that they'll have one little Sierra cup that they've carried on all their climbs, and then someone uses it and they attack them with an ice axe. Well, it's not because they were so hung up on that particular Sierra cup, it's just at high altitude. It wears you thin, you don't think as well. Generally, when you argue at high altitude, you have to tell the person, hey, I'm really mad at you, but I know it's the altitude. You know, so then you can carry on your little discussion. Okay? The area of positive mental attitude, the things that we'll talk about, will be basic fears. Everybody has generally some fears. Mine's jungle spiders. I used to jog in the jungle, be zipping down the trail early in the morning just before the sun came up, and I'd run in these spider webs, it felt like someone threw a fishnet over me. And there'd be some big spider come running down to get me. And after doing that a dozen times or so, you pretty much get hung up that this spider, you know, is really not your friend. So now I don't have a very good tolerance of jungle spiders. But there's other fears that people have. Fear of darkness. Warner's afraid of darkness. Judy has to leave her lights on. I'm kidding. I pick on Warner. He best comes in when we talk about losing body heat.
I'd like to mention that this is a historic moment because this is the sixth and final act that we're having.
I won't have done more. But we'll talk about basic fears and how they affect you in a winter community. And we'll find out that a lot of you that haven't done skiing in the winter, especially overnight, if you plan extensive trips, you run into this thing called sensory deprivation, where everything is white or green, and we tend to lose our reality contact. Same thing happens in the desert. You find that people live in Equal, Wyoming, or one of those small places, just a gas station. You go and talk to them, they really seem like they have a bizarre attitude. They do. Because many of them are kind of sensory deprived. This is where you see mass murders. The guy just wakes up in the middle of the night and kills all six people in town. It's generally based upon sensory deprivation. The fact the wind's blowing across them or something like that. Those same type of problems develop in a winter community. Now, while you're out hunting for the powder scheme, not around here, Warner won't allow you to be sensory deprived while you're here. Okay. So those same things pop up. We also know that under this positive mental attitude, we tend to have problems with determination. And I kind of alluded to that before. We're going to do this trip whether it kills us or not. Okay. And that's really the wrong attitude to have. And that's very pretty much a fatalist attitude, because if you take that as your main motto, you're really never going to get anywhere at skiing or doing anything, because you're going to spend more energy, you're going to be worrying more. It's not going to be a very enjoyable trip. In the winter time, you have a very strong need to go slow, because you don't want to perspire. If you don't see too many animals perspiring in the winter, it tends to kill their insulation value. So you want to take your time, because we know it burns less calories. You start trudging through the snow and using energy in a non-productive manner. It takes more calories to replace it than if you kind of move very slowly. You want to be warm. So these things come under a proper positive attitude. In the area of shelter, very important to always feel warm. If you're cold in any environment, you're screwing up. So you shouldn't be overly warm, you shouldn't be perspiring, but you should feel warm. You should feel comfortable. If you're not comfortable, you're draining energy. Calories are going away faster. You're finding out that your body itself, if you're cold, you tend to dry out better. I don't know how many people have seen it happen in wintertime, but once you're really cold, your skin is really dry. You're putting out a lot of insensible perspiration just to keep your skin moist, which means you become extremely dehydrated if you allow yourself to get really cold. You run into a problem when people are really cold, that their blood supply is constricted, so they're routing more blood more frequently through their kidneys, which creates waste products that make them urinate more often. It's called urinary dialysis. So if you're cold, you urinate more frequently, and point of interest, but it also means you're getting dehydrated more, okay, because the more often you urinate, the more often you're losing fluid, which means dehydration is just as bad a problem as it is in the wintertime as it is in the summertime, because you're wearing a lot of bulky clothes, your perspiration is being absorbed, urinary dialysis, and this leads to bad nutrition. So shelter is an extension of clothing, and vice versa. You have a maximum shelter, you only need minimum clothing. Maximum clothing, you only need a minimum amount of shelter. And we'll talk about that when we get into snow shelters and how they work. And these latest little formulas you can use. In the area of rest, it's always important, you know, to consider that in your trip. You don't want to plan, you know, a trip that's overly aggressive for the members. You keep set the pace to fit the slowest person and a variety of things like that that we'll cover. And in the area of water, kind of all mentioned, dehydration is a problem. We know that if the urine's really discolored, you know, if you get those little snow flowers, if you urinate in the snow on a trip, if it's really dark, then you need water. You really do. If it's close to yellow or clear, you're okay. If it looks like coffee stains, you have someone that's severely dehydrated. And you need to correct that situation because they become mentally inefficient. Some instructors are mentally efficient, so they must be dehydrated all the time. But needless to say, if you see those little things, you should correct it. And in the area of food, we'll talk about that. A lot of people tank up in the winter community. It's important. And you don't want to tank up to the point where you gain a lot of weight. But you do want to make sure that when you plan a trip, it's based upon an adequate number of calories. Not just useless calories like Hostess Twinkies, but ones that are really productive based upon a fair amount of carbohydrates, fats, as well as proteins. And we'll hit that also. Because if all you eat with sugar-type foods, you'll find that you get that little sugar high when you come down. In the winter community, you come down pretty hard. You have to have a certain amount of fats and carbohydrates planned into your diet when you're doing strenuous activities, as well as proteins, in order to maintain and repair the body. But these type of items, especially here, we'll hit when we talk about mountain problems. We'll hit a little bit more on weather and lapse rate as far as what happens with the air as we go higher and how it drops in temperature. Does anybody have any specific questions? Am I talking too fast?
Mm-hmm. Well, the man that we first saw who died had a nice room, and I suppose the man who was in the automobile had a knife when he cut his cookie. Did that happen just carry a knife or a small hatchet?
Well, generally not a hatchet, John, but they usually carry a knife. And we have a thing called the 13 essentials, or 10 essentials as people list it. And one of those essentials is having a pocket knife. And it's generally a good idea. You'll find out that it's a very useful tool. Even in shelter building, like in Colorado, when you get a lot of wind-packed snow, you can't punch through with your hand. You know, it's just a lightweight, sometimes it's a lot deeper than a lightweight layer. If you had a pocket knife, you could probably cut through it in order to start your shelter construction. I had a student in Ellensburg at a winter survival seminar who built her entire shelter out of windblown snow just by cutting it out with a pocket knife. So it's a very valuable tool to have with you. But you also want to remember, and we'll talk about this in frostbite, that if you cut yourself outside in a winter environment, you really, when you reach down and go through a chunk of cheese, you'll find that cheese is as hard as a brick. You can kill squirrels with it if you're not careful. But if you go all the way through whatever you're cutting and cut yourself, and you develop a slight taste of shock, which happens when you have a real strong cut, you know, maybe you just don't like blood, you're probably going to freeze your fingers. So you also have to be very careful in handling any type of sharp instruments in winter. I've had a lot of students in the past that have, you know, cut themselves in the field, and in many cases they've had frostbite in just a short amount of time. That's one thing you have to consider. Okay.
You were talking earlier about when you were talking about fat, like fat and water. Like if a person doesn't have food in it, like if you have enough water, you can produce how many calories did you say?
I think a pound of fat is about 2,500 pound of body fat, right. But you'll find out there's other things that goes on. There's a thing called ketone acidosis, which is when people go on brown rice and orange juice diet, the reason they sometimes don't lose weight and they actually strain is because your fat also stores like lead and things like that, a lot of really bad environmental problems. Okay? So when you start to break it down, it really gives you a bad time. You find out people see visions and things like that. So in many cases, I don't know if you try to eat, you go on a fast, you won't lose any weight that day. Because you have a natural survival mechanism that doesn't allow you to break down fat too readily because it doesn't want a lot of these environmental pollutants being released in your body. I forgot all the things that fat store, but they store a lot of bad things that you absorb and inject. Okay? So it's not always true. You find out some individuals metabolize fat better than others, but generally they have a system that's in pretty good condition. If your system's slow, you haven't been exercising it, you might have to wait 3 days before your fat breaks down. And that's why a lot of these starvation diets can start losing weight. So,
Okay, that was my
question. Depends on the individual. Really does. If it's, you know, a situation where you stack your carbohydrates prior to the trip, the fat's going to come down easier than if you have it. And if you're calorie depleted and then you start worrying about breaking down fat, it might take you a couple days to get it in gear. Okay? Any other questions? I'd encourage you to come to the other session.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Can I do a question with you? I think you could start a lot, even when I get very lightly. What do you do to break?
I have the same problem. I usually just wear a windshield. Like, made out of real beauty material, like a cabin jacket or, you know, a shirt you put over, just to block the wind. I'll wear that, maybe it's just going into the top. You know, so if I do perspire, I don't saturate my clothing. And I really have that happen, for sure, but you don't want to expose yourself to the point where you're wearing a t-shirt, because that's not a very good idea either, because you're going to run into that problem of your capillaries closing down, driving more blood to your kidneys, and you're going to become dehydrated. Either way, you're going to lose water, but one is worse than two either. So a lot of times, it just comes because of a lot of people over-insulate their lower body. They'll wear really heavy knickers. And if you can just wear like a pair of running shorts and wind pants and a wind shirt, I mean, this isn't once you start out. Generally, you're cold while you're getting the fever of the day. Once you get started, you might have warm-up pants you could pull off and get started. A lot of you that are thin build probably could see the thermal underwear on in a parka and never sweat. It just depends on the individual. And how much steam you do, you find out the more steam you do in the season, less it's required. Okay. I didn't have any questions. But then I encourage you to come back. I think you'll find out that movies get better. I show these particular movies just because there's a pattern to what I like to teach. And I think you'll find out it'll all tie together by the time the course is over. And thank you for coming, man. So I think I'll take a slow approach, let's see if I can find some thoughts, and kind of outline what happens when your body gets cold and some of the natural responses you have. I'll just draw a quick picture of beauty up here. It's winter, and we know that if we were to take you and put it outside now, if you drop a little or three, or even if you weren't going to do that grass, if you just have it stand outside for a while, you've got a tremendous amount of blood supply going around. Okay? Mm-hmm. How much of the blood supply is limited once it starts to get cold? The first thing that happens when you get cold is that our blood vessels can split, and that way we can serve vital heat. During the summertime, you know, standing on the carry away excess body heat. The first duty outside, you find out the blood vessels that are close to the surface, you can shift, and automatically, you know, kind of like the hairs in your body tend to stand up, and it's just a natural response. Okay? It's a good speed sign. You find out that that's no problem. If the outside skin temperature can reach about 50 degrees and it feels really cold, but it doesn't affect the internal core. So inside, it's still going to be 98.6 or 99 degrees. But if we were to couple that with a lot of activity or standing out there for a long period of time, or put water on it while she's in a cold environment, you find out real soon that eventually the energy that she's putting out just to keep warm is not going to use the energy she's got in her tank. And what happens is you have a deficit where she becomes completely exhausted. And as a person starts to shiver, or as a person gives up a tremendous amount of heat to the environment in a variety of ways, that person becomes hypothermic, which means a lowering of the body than a core temperature. And you know, as long as you live at 98.6, you can run and jump and move very adequately. And all the chemical balances in the system work really well. But if you start to lose body heat just 0.1 degree, automatically what happens? It starts to shiver. So the liver releases a little glucose to help along with the energy. But if in fact that shiver, which is a natural reaction, natural response to the body, doesn't bring the temperature back up, to start shivering harder. How many people have really shivered hard? And really super hard. Now I'm sure some of you see people shiver so hard they're uncontrollable. They couldn't tie their shoes if they had to. Well, their body temperature drops significantly. And this can either happen in a rapid way by being in cold, wet weather, or it could happen over a long period of time by just simply laying out in the snow, or being in a snow shelter, or an inadequate sleeping bag. It can happen over many, many hours. A couple weeks ago, I had a survival class at Eastern, and they put them out in the Persian wearing and what they can fit in the volume of a Coca-Cola can. And one of Margaret Finn's best became hypothermic. She was sitting in a shelter, you know, having a good time, made it out of pine branches and things like that. And she made it all through the night. But the next day, I went to check and she wasn't really speaking all that coherently. Had to get out of the shelter. And as soon as she started to move around, she just started hopping around. And she stopped sitting and said, "What's that?" And soon she started sitting again. And the only getting temperature was 96 degrees. So with her, it wasn't a situation that was really rapid and fast, the body core dropping from being exposed to the elements. It was an overnight affair where the temperature dropped. But either way, there's some interesting things that happen as the temperature goes down. And this here at 99 and close to that, at 96, you get really violent shivering. Now, I'm not saying that you have to set up some kind of experience. This is going to affect people differently. I find out that some of my students in the past, if the temperature just drops a little bit, they go into uncontrollable shivering. So there's a difference in age and physical condition. But we'll say if the temperature drops to 2 degrees, at 96, you're going to feel cold, you're going to be shivering. You won't be able to do complex tasks. You won't be able to do mathematical problems. You'll be able to speak intelligently, do a lot of physiological work with your large muscle mass, but the small tasks that require a little bit of difficulty in thinking, you won't be able to perform. So this means that we realize that a person shivering really hard can't make good decisions. So if this drops and goes down to 94, we're just using the 2 degree angle. At that point, shivering is really intense. Speaking is difficult. You're having a problem because the teeth are going together. Your skin is so hard that people are just da-da-da-da-da-da like that. A lot of you, you know, were here this summer, and I was going to have hypothermia. Holding time, and they were feeling so hard, people were sticking sticks in their mouth. You know, it's just they would hit the teeth. Mm-hmm. And they could just turn it sick. That's really going on shivering. But as it goes down, the problem starts to develop. We'll say at 92 degrees, the person's going into a stupor. They're kind of like a walking zombie. They're kind of going around, they can't think, they can't really help themselves. They get it to a point where they're not really all that coherent. Their speech is going to be sluggish, their fine motor skills are gone completely. All they have is a large muscle mass that they can deal with. So in some cases, like a hypothermic son in Mount Rainier, he's been put out on Friday, so he spent the night out at rain, which is in the winter. We saw her Saturday morning with her two friends, and it was so cold that she couldn't pass that little belief to take her backpack off. She said it was frozen. It was 40 degrees outside. We know it only takes about 2 pounds of pressure. She's an adult, pull it off. She couldn't do it. She couldn't get her fingers together. We set the temperature season around 92. She has actually been so cold for so long that she had passed the shivering stage and her temperature was really dropping rapidly. When we got her in front of a fire and warmed her back up to 94, she started shivering again. It's kind of interesting. So it's really an insidious problem, the fact that it sneaks up on her. People who spend the night in their cars, alcoholics for example, or even people who party too hard, they sleep in their car the next day at 15 minutes later, and they're dead. They're not really dead. It's just so cold at that point, the body doesn't have the energy or the heat to do anything. And a lot of men who play dead, and as soon as they get in the warm room, they start feeling again. It's been there some time. But what about this automobile accident where the person turns into a steam and they're trapped in the car for 4 hours and still survive? They were so cold, they needed very little oxygen, because as your temperature goes down, you're going to change the same thing. The respiration as well as your pulse. And this is why when you're dealing with someone who's really cold, and this is not resting, you're not dead until a woman's there. I used to use body recovery when I was in Colorado, and that was always the rule. You always treated the person as if they were alive. Once you got them warmed up and then you found out there was no pulse, then they could declare them dead. But you'll find out that people's pulse will get so slow that they do like one beat every couple seconds. But yet they're still alive and they're still having normal brain function. It's just that they're so extremely cold, the muscles fail to work because all the blood is pooled around just between the heart, the lungs, and the brain. The rest of your body doesn't have any more blood supply. And this happens a lot lower than this, but at 90 degrees, the pilot light goes out. This is a critical stage. This is the point where someone's so cold that their metabolism shuts down, their body no longer produces heat, no longer shivers. And below that, it starts to drop with dramatic things. Pulmonary edema, frothing up blood, and a variety of other systems that happen to a person, such as cardiac arrest. The blood is just so cold that the heart can no longer pump it. But in the interim, the reason you lose your mental capability is the fact that you're pumping cold blood up to the brain. And that's what's really creating some of the mental incompetencies that develop from hypothermia. So if you're looking at a definition where the body core temperature is lower, the very complex system, as the temperature down, our respiration decreases, our pulse decreases, our body gets really cold, that also means we're becoming acidotic and having chemical imbalance. Because prior to this, we had a normal blood supply, normal respiration, we're blowing off carbon dioxide, we're getting rid of lactic acid, but as soon as you slow your respiration down, we find out that all these chemicals build up in our system. We're not blowing them off as readily. So this also means that besides a person being cold, it's probably also chemically imbalanced. And in most cases, the studies of hypothermia, they're usually dehydrated and calorie depleted. That's an important thing to remember. There's never been a case of someone who's eaten too much becoming a hypothermic. As long as you're eating and taking in fluids, it's very rare that you can actually have problems in cold weather. And the temperatures we're talking about are not extremely cold temperatures for human bodies. Most hypothermia cases happen between 30 and 50 degrees. Okay, so let's take a look at the way heat is lost in a person becomes hypothermic. Now, when you're at 90 degrees, you're incapable of self-help. But to get there, there's a lot of factors that come about. And I'll kind of look at these one at a time. These are called the Frosty Five. And the first one, the most important one, and number one, is radiation. And we know that an uncovered head and neck radiates our body and stimulates and radiates our car. And during the summertime, if we cool our head with some water, we find out really fast that we stop perspiring and feel a little bit better, especially when it's hot. But in the wintertime, we know that we can lose about 50% of our body heat. Our total body heat can go out to an uncovered head and neck. The reason for that is because we have at least the minimum 20% of our blood supply always going to the head. This is why whenever we do a facial test, they rarely get it back. There's always a good blood supply going there. Working on that type of blood supply. Now, we know there's very little insulation on our head. It's going to give us longer hair than we're seeing more of this and then we're scared of it. But generally, none of us have that head, like we're instructed. But generally, we have a problem where we're radiating a lot of heat off. And we can experiment with this. You know, we had speakers on our campus where we used to run through the dormitories naked running steam out. They had 50% of the heat problems taken care of. They only had 50% of it really at a year. And you can try that. Next time you go skiing, put a little face mask on and pull a hat on and see how warm you get really fast. Because most of your body heat moves through your head and neck. And it's actually so much that if he was walking through a cold room without a hat on, if we took a picture with a thermograph, which is a heat sensitive film, he would have a plume 3 feet over the top of her head sticking out of there. And
had so much heat coming out that you really called the incredible human machine, which showed a person jogging, taking the photograph that they showed, and as they jogged, the screen got longer and longer and longer. 6 feet long, the heat goes off the top of your head. And this is the mechanics of also how you get rid of dead cells. The body heat rises on your system, and as you start to move up the body, it swirls around and moves up, and all of that just picks up all of those cells and just microscopic and deposits it in the heat stream and drops behind. This is why dogs can pick up your scent, because it's picking up the scent of these dead cells. Which is also the reason why people wear suspenders in winter. Because you find out if you put a belt across here, the heat tries to come up and doesn't get anywhere. It keeps being forced back down. Those of you who ride bicycles, a lot of times you put a rubber band around one foot, and you're not to get caught in the corner of the feet and the wind. You find that after pumping the bicycle for a little bit of time, that one leg is really hot. And the reason for that is because you've trapped so much heat, it's trying to get out, there's no place for it to go. When normal walking, you find out heat gets blown back down to the cuff because you can't get through the belt. In order to keep warm and get in the winter time, this is what we call fascial tan. And so that heat comes up and helps keep your chest warm because it's trying to rise anyway. The word exiting is exposed head and neck. So 50% of our body can move at 40 degrees, and at 5 degrees temperature, 75% of our body can be lost if you're uncovered head and neck. This is why it's very important to consider a very good type of headgear in a winter community, one that can protect you from cold, wet weather, one that can deal with the same heat. The second factor in the frosty five is also the second more deadly factor that we deal with. Radiation is the most common way to lose heat. The second one is convection. Because we know if exposed skin is radiating heat out, and we have wind chill, or wind currents coming past us, pulling away, we'll tend to lose body heat very rapidly. And I think this is best shown in the wind chill chart that was designed by the military many years ago. And I'll come back to this slide. So what it shows on one side is the actual temperature, excuse me, across the top. I need a pen to point to this. Right across here, we have the actual thermometer reading. And let's kind of deal with the temperature that we had yesterday. So I saw a page with 25 degrees or so. We'll say 20 degrees in the morning hours. So if we look here at 20 degrees, and we had it fairly calm, so at calm it is 20 degrees. But as soon as the wind starts to pick up, we'll say it has a wind of 20 degrees, like you see it plugged in here somewhere. With a 20 mile an hour wind, which is quite common on this top, you're going to have equivalent temperature of minus 10 degrees. And that's the same minus 10 degrees as if the thermometer said it, then we're talking about uncovered skin. Any exposed skin will feel and experience the same temperature as minus 10 degrees. So let's look at it when you're talking about your temperatures of minus 9 that you had, which will record for this year. And we'll just look at 10 degrees at that particular time. Minus 33 degrees. A 10 mile an hour wind would best be indicated by if there was a flag out here, that it would probably, you know, be rippling and almost straight out. Okay? 10 mile an hour wind. Generally, this area doesn't get a lot of wind, from what I managed to understand. But why you cross country skiing, backpacking, winter camping, as soon as you get into a situation where the wind comes up, we have a multiplying factor. A lot of studies have been done in heat pockets throughout the United States where they take a person, put them in a business suit, put them in a heat locker, they stand around at like 20 degrees and bring the heat, it should be colder than that. There's no problem, but as soon as they introduce wind into the heat locker, the person can't stand it. So why is that? So as long as you're radiating heat and trapping it close to your skin, there's really no problem with dealing with cold weather, but as soon as you allow wind in any mountain environment, you're going to have some kind of wind. It pulls away the 3D and embodies you. You have a layer right next to your skin within a quarter of an inch. And you can do this experiment really easy. Just take a piece of tinfoil and pull it a quarter of an inch away from your arm, and you find out that you can extend and reflect the body heat back in. So this is why a space blanket tends to work on some individuals. You want to use a metallic-sized blanket to put around you because it's easy to reflect that wind in the anyway. So if you have a strong wind coming by, it sucks all of that heat away, and you want it to be a real problem because you radiate the heat away, and you convect the current to pull the body heat away. So the wind flow chart, we'll have a pocket-sized wind flow chart for you after this presentation to keep you kind of carry around and get an idea of things. As it relates to wind chill. Conduction. This is one of the lesser areas of losing heat in most winter communities. Conduction is just any time you touch something colder than yourself, you find out that area reaches a heat load, reaching a greater concentration and lesser concentration. When you came in here and sat down on these chairs, yourself kind of cold, well, that's just your body trying to warm them up. Cold is just the absence of heat. If you touch something that's cold, you're giving up body heat to that particular surface. Where this does become a problem is when you touch metal fuel bottles. If you're carrying out backpacks, because the fuel itself tends to drop to the lowest temperature. If you have them out in the snow, they're not ready to go and grab them. You give up so much body heat so rapidly that the conduction will freeze right through them. A lot of you probably have been in areas that's been really cold, and any metal you touch is pushing a car, for example, to leave a little bit of spin on the trunk. Okay. Some of the elite brothers at school out in Colorado, the library door was metal. And you have to keep warm water around there because people would always be grabbing that door with the mittens off, and you'd be stuck to it. They tried that cool. You know, they're standing around, you know, kind of hiding their arms. But eventually, you know, the longer you hang on there, the colder it gets, the more painful it gets. Someone would have to either pull them off the door, bring out warm water for it on him for it. A lot of them used to lift the runners and sled. They can go a little bit faster. I want to have time to that. But conduction actually affects us when we try to sit down in the snow. It's important that we see that we always take a break if we're doing this task. A break means getting off your feet, setting your pack down and sitting on it. If you can take a break and sit in the snow, you give up a fair amount of your body. By direct contact. But conduction is one of the lesser ones as far as talking about hypothermia. It's more apparent in cases of frostbite. So evaporation and condensation. You know that wet clothing loses its insulating value almost completely if it's cotton. If it's wool, it retains, you know, 40-60%, depending upon the quality of the wool. But what happens when you're dealing with evaporation? Is the fact that any time you have water on your skin, you want to create it into a vapor to get rid of it. Maybe that's what happens during the summertime. You start to perspire, it evaporates, and it cools. Well, that uses energy. And that uses body energy. If you have a situation of taking Becky outside and hosing her down with a hose in this type of environment, you'll find out real soon that her body heat is pushing through the clothing will evaporate the moisture out of it. But to change that moisture to a vapor is going to take a lot of her body heat. A better example might be the fact that some of you have been a backer of using alcohol. You notice how cold the alcohol feels? So you can even leave it in a warm room and the alcohol still feels cool because it evaporates so rapidly as it changes from a liquid to a vapor. Another example might be earlier this evening, a lot of people used to go to the beach or used to go swimming so they don't get sunburned in areas where it's fairly warm. If you're wearing a wet, clinging t-shirt, you get out of the pool and you really feel cold. And that's because you're evaporating all this heat off of your, excuse me, all this water off of your body and you're using body heat. So it's taking away heat that would normally be used to keep you warm. So this, in summary, means that anytime you have wet clothing against your skin, you're giving up a fair amount of body heat. This is a problem that's really hard for us to deal with in a winter community. When we talk about clothing, we'll try to cover the idea of wearing a ventilating layer and not to try to trap in all this moisture by always wearing waterproof gear. Because you know if you always wear waterproof rain gear, even when it's not raining outside, you're trapping the humidity right next to your skin. And that's why Chicago feels really cold at 30 degrees and Denver doesn't. because Chicago has humidity. By wearing any gear when you don't need to wear it, you create your own personal humidity, which creates more cold. And in Alaska, it is one that's extremely hard to deal with, and it is a problem in a real cold weather community, and that's respiration. And we know basically that when we pull in air, regardless of the temperature outside, we warm it up to 70 degrees in our lungs before we expel it. And to warm it up, first we humidify it with our nose, and second we bring it down to our sinus cavity and let it warm up there. This is why when we breathe really hard in the winter, we find out our nose runs very frequently. The drier the air, the more your nose runs. Maybe you need a mustache from the problem. So respiration can be kind of slowed down by using a rebreather. We didn't bring our sock with you because usually every time you show it, no one believes it. So we brought a scarf this time. But if you can, you just a scarf or with a sock, and you know, something that's tubular, you can just have it set up a little strap over your nose and breathe through it. And as you exhale with 70 degree air, you warm this up, and so next time you pull in air, it's going to be warm. It takes a little while to work, but you can try this of wrapping this around your face and bundling up. And after a little while, you're really going to get warm because you're going to pre-warm your air. And it's just a simple system. A lot of you can make a face mask, and that's going to be crochet. A wool face mask designed to go over your nose and mouth. After a while, it'll ice up. But if it's wool, all you have to do is smash it on something hard, and it'll drop out and you can start to scratch. With a scarf, all you do is rotate it, and then you get another spot to start from. Eventually, you can do just about the whole thing. But you're going to be warm while you're doing it. The key thing here is, you do it in temperatures above 20 degrees, you're not going to gain anything. And the reason for that is there's so much humidity in the air above 20 degrees, you're going to have to rotate it just about every few breaths, you know, like every 5 minutes. But if you're sleeping out in temperatures, especially those who are interested in sleeping in snow caves, this is a standard part of your staying warm gear, because if you lay down in your sleeping bag, it goes over your face, and as it freezes up, you just leave it throughout the night. And no matter what the temperature is outside, this is really going to aid you in keeping warm. Maybe because you're really vulnerable at that point in time. You never want to touch your head inside your sleeping bag like you see a lot of people do. Because then you get this big spot of moisture forming in your bag and eventually it freezes inside there. Or it freezes on top of your chest. Okay? So these are the frosty five. And we'll cover them briefly again once we show the film. But this movie that's coming on is called By Nature's Rule. Has a group of five hypers that become hypothermic, kind of defines the hypothermic a little bit better. Two of them really get no hassle, and they come out and they proceed to move afterwards. So what I want to look for is while these people are hiking or climbing along, look to see these frosty five, find out where they lost body heat out, where was their radiation and radiating heat out, where was their convection, the wind chill current. And then you can talk about convection of sitting on the ground, respiration of breathing, and what's the last one? Evaporation. Okay? And that'll be the moisture that evaporates off the skin, which tends to burn body heat very rapidly. And then after the film, I'll ask some of you, you know, depending upon who the actor was, and the movie just kind of explains why one person got hypothermia and another one didn't. So we'll be looking for physiological differences in the people, and why, as well as their physical dress and appearance. Okay. Are you a possessive now?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can get insurance for you.
Not a good. And that's one thing that is the part And that's kind of where the mountain snow, since it isn't really that cold out, it's really been snow. So there's no conservation. We want to keep our clothes dry. We want to put our rain gear on before we are wet. That way we still can retain our clothing for this environment. What about Linda? How come she didn't come hunt this time? She had the worst raincoat of anyone, yeah. All she had was a piece of
plastic.
It's warm. And she had no sweaters, had mittens.
What about the idea of keeping on hikes before? Maybe prior to this season, and then you're very sick. That's even possible, right? Now, her rain jacket was definitely inadequate. We need to point that out, because we still received one year, and everybody went out and bought those really lightweight rain jackets. And you know, they said, well, if you get hypothermia, it must work. So don't buy that type of rain jacket if you're in that particular market. I think a plastic garbage bag would work just as well as that did. Go back really quickly over to Frosty Five, so everybody has a understanding of all of those elements. And I'm going to show you a series of slides of some hikers, backpackers, we're in the Sierras. These particular slides were taken by one of the members of that group, and they took the camera off his body and had the film process. So it's a sequence of pictures of that they shot up until the time they died. Hypothermia. It's a very unique sequence that comes out of Southern California, but we still are holding basically because a lot of people resemble, you know, people that I've known in Holden. I don't know if that's but the factors we'll be looking for in this slide series, you know, are really summarized right here, the fact that we do have a problem with radiation and we can radiate a tremendous amount of our body heat away. A good example of radiant heat loss is, I don't know how many of you slept outside, but it just seems like when you sleep outside in your yard or wherever, if you sleep out in the open, you tend to be a lot colder than if you sleep under a tree. Right? So that tree is actually cutting down a lot on that radiant heat loss. Same thing goes with the tent. You know, although the tent offers some protection from moisture and snow and rain, depending on the quality and type of tents you have, we find out it also breaks up this radiant heat loss, and it adds about 5 degrees of warmth. The tent's about 5 degrees warmer than the outside air, usually. That adds a little bit of barrier against radiant heat loss. The way to use the time to prevent convection heat loss is wearing wind gear. And I really recommend wearing gear of wind pants, lightweight nylon pants over your bolts, when you're learning how to cross-country ski, because I know some of you tend to be the dive bombers, you know, where you kind of dive into the snow. I don't know if you're lost. Looks like you lost something to dive in the plane if you can get it. Especially Becky, she just is a super diver. Okay, so wind gear is going to keep the snow from sticking to you, because you know as soon as you come inside and snow in the camp, it melts. Even in the outside environment, if you stay really active, it either freezes the pants and melts, which reduces the insulating value. But wind gear isn't going to hold in all that much moisture from your perspiration, but it is going to allow the snow not to stick to your wool. And that's probably one piece of equipment that I would highly recommend. And during the summertime, if you make an investment in a pair of wind pants, you can wear them with 15 boxer shorts or underwear or whatever as a prevention against mosquitoes. Because if you buy a pair of wind pants, you'll find out mosquitoes can't zap through it, and you can just wear that on the hike and trail. It keeps dirt, you know, from collecting on your legs. It allows you to breathe really well, and the bugs can't get through. And if you've ever been in northern Minnesota, our equivalent is Canada, where there's a lot of bugs, you'll find out that a pair of nylon wind pants will keep you from biting through. And it's a lot better than trying to patch up the holes they create, some flies and things like that. So when going down, we have a conduction. Basically, what we can say here is if you're working in an outside environment, you always want to have something between you and whatever is cold. Sitting on cold surfaces create other problems besides body heat loss. You know, it's kind of a predisposing factor to being hemorrhoid, which is really no fun in the winter community either. Questions? If you that in the skin, surely it would be. And because you know that insulation is dead airspace, and anything that's plastic has no dead air trap. We talked about dead airspace in the clothing, and he's going to make points again. But yeah, if you wore just plastic against your skin, like if you were being hard and perspiring a lot, you know, if you just put on your wind shoe on top of you, you'll find out that you need to get a clammy sensation because there's a direct, you know, heat loss because it's a solid object. Conducts heat away rapidly. Well, a lot of you probably notice the difference in the type of mittens that people wear if you're mittens, gloves, and things like that. And we'll talk about those later, but sometimes you'll find out it's called the dish rag theory. You ever try to grab a hot skillet with a wet dish rag, and all of a sudden heat transfers to the rag in your hand? And you don't need to try it in the kitchen. I wouldn't recommend it, but like a cast iron skillet, trying to grab that handle with a wet dish rag or a wet pot holder goes right through. So this conduction is increased, especially when dealing with snow, if your clothes are wet. Or if you're sitting on a cold surface, you find out it extracts body heat at a rapid rate. 23 times greater than if it was dry. 32 times, I'm sorry. So in many cases, we need to be concerned about conduction, especially when we're damp. Okay. And then evaporation, we know we don't want to perspire in a winter environment. We want to kind of act like animals. We never see animals perspiring. We're always going to maintain a warm layer or warm temperature. We don't want to be overly warm. We don't want to be too cold. And that'll avoid a lot of perspiration by staying dry. So then with respiration, we talked about a rebreather, but physical conditioning helps because we tend to have less oxygen demand if we're in good shape, and when we're not, we find out that training for our activity of skiing in the village itself, the pass on prior to skiing out in the mountainous areas really helps as far as the conditioning level, you breathe less. We know if you go to higher elevations, you tend to breathe more because the air is thinner. And that's the area the rebreather might come in. We actually have something to breathe through. And there's a lot of different designs that people probably come up with and improvise for face masks or rebreathers. And there's so many people that do knit and crochet, I'm sure you're probably talking into making a prototype pattern, I would think. Okay. Let's talk about the prevention a little bit more when we talk about the treatment after we see these slides. Now I'm going to have to talk to you from back here. If you can't hear me, just shout if you would. Before I turn these on, kind of the history behind this, this is the Sierra Singles Club out of California. The Sierra Club has a group of singles. We're going out on a trip, about 10 of them were going along. Five of them were just going into hike in one area to base camp. The other five were going to climb a fairly non-technical peak. You know, it'd be like climbing some of the peaks around here in the winter when there's a lot of snow on them. So the idea was it was a pickup group. There was no designated leader, which is really common in these type of things. And it's pretty common as people see out of the village. There's no official leader, a foul weather leader, someone who can call it off. So the general condition of the group was that really strong people on one end and really weak ones on the other. Some of them had excellent equipment, some of them had lightweight gear. And there's a strong correlation I'll kind of mention later on, but it seems like those people in good shape that had fairly good equipment survived, and those people that were in poor condition didn't. The wife of the person who killed sued the Mountain Rescue Group who processed these slides, but Mountain Rescue said that they had to distribute them because they were the most significant slides, at least for education, that had come out in a long time. But, and they won the court case. So the slides themselves are taken by one of the victims prior to him dying, and it leads right up to the accident scene, and it's really a good interest to all of them, too. Here, so this is a good starting out. This goes across the screen. Now notice it's fairly lightly clad. It's not really cold. One just feels free. They're hiking into the area. So it's not a situation we're dealing with extreme cold. When it's really cold, it seems like people tend to dress a little bit better. And in some cases, they know where we are. The type of weather we have outside right now is ideal hypothermia weather. Okay, if it was rainy, it would even be better weather to become hypothermic. So it's 80 to 50 degrees in that range. It's wet outside, the wind was blowing, and the essence is where you lose a lot of body heat. And it would probably take a long time before it happened, but if you were fatigued from skiing and dehydrated, lack of food, it could come upon pretty fast. Skiers, downhill skiers, tend to be on diet, have daily breakfast for the quickest type of service we know. One was a half an hour. She got on the ski lift, rode it up, it was slow, it was just starting out in the morning. By the time she got to the top of the lift and started down, which was approximately 30 minutes,
he fell over.